Welcome into the Ether, a podcast focusing on all things Ethereum, the leading blockchain for decentralized applications. I'm Eric Connor, your host and founder of ETHHub, a decentralized information hub for Ethereum. Into the Ether features deep dives on topics with prominent guests in the community, as well as ETHHub weekly recaps featuring Anthony Sisano. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the ETHHub weekly recap. On these episodes, we discuss the ETHHub weekly newsletter, which covers news from the Ethereum ecosystem and crypto space as a whole. This week, we're covering the news from April 1st to April 7th. Hey, Anthony, you want to walk us through the news?
Hey, Eric. Sure. So a couple of things this week. I'll be at EdCon as of tonight, my time. So it's currently the morning when we're recording this for me, but I'll be in EdCon Wednesday night until Friday night. So if you're there, come and find me. I have free ETHHub stickers to give away, and I really want to meet as many people as I can, as I'm only there for a couple of days. Happy to grab a beer with anyone. So yeah, if you're there, just DM me on Twitter and we'll set something up for sure. And also wanted to touch on a blog post that you put out this week, Eric, about the ETH 2.0 economics and the kind of the basics around that. Did you want to walk us through kind of what your goal was for that blog post and what you explained in there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously, we touch on the economics a lot. And I guess, first and foremost, I would point people to ETHHub and to our monetary policy page to kind of how Ethereum's monetary policy has worked in the past, I guess, present and future as well. My goal, though, was to kind of like align what's happening now as far as the economics on Ethereum go. And, you know, miners get paid rewards through block rewards, and they're securing the network, right? So essentially almost $1 billion a year gets paid out to miners to secure the network, and the more hash rate we have, the better. Of course, we've gone through some block reward reductions because Ether price has shot up a lot, and the community and the users have decided that, you know, we don't need to pay that much, or we were overpaying at a point. That's the proof of work side. And then I kind of transition into how it's going to look on proof of stake and walk through how we can have a lower total network issuance through proof of stake, because we only have to pay rewards to those that are actually staking, as opposed to kind of like, you can think of, we're almost paying the entire network almost on the proof of work side. So to have the same security on the proof of stake side, we can have like a 0.2% issuance rate per year versus we're up around 4.5% right now. So I just kind of walk through like what, if you're going to stake, I talked about my estimated costs for staking as far as hardware and energy and bandwidth and all that goes. And then what kind of your average staking node is going to earn, all the way from if you were staking one validator node, which is 32 Ether, all the way up to, I think I put maybe 1,000 validators on there. So anyways, yeah, just go check it out. It's on a Medium. It's on our Medium for ETHHub. So just search ETHHub Medium if you haven't seen it yet. And it's just, I guess the simplest way I can put it is just a very basic overview of the ETH 2.0 economics.
Yeah, it was a great post. I think we need to be putting out more stuff like that for kind of the newbies in the ecosystem, or people who just don't have a clear picture of what the economics are going to be like for Ethereum. As you said, that monetary policy page covers a lot, but we wanted to be doing deeper dives into it. So I think your blog post was a good start there, definitely.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point too. If people, we definitely want to get more content on our Medium. So if there's topics or subjects that you would like for us to cover, just reach out to us on Twitter and we'd be happy to write for ones that we think are the most interesting.
Yeah, exactly. We're always keen. And we're always keen to amplify others' messages as well. So if you've written a really good blog post and you want to amplify it through ETHHub, just reach out to us and, you know, we're happy to include it in the newsletter and, you know, talk about it on the podcast and maybe included on the ETHHub Medium publication as well. So we're looking to branch out into more long form pieces as well. It's just a timing issue for us, but obviously there's a lot of community members that put out a lot of great content. So for sure, we'd love to amplify that through ETHHub. So I wanted to quickly mention what we have lined up for the next couple of months in ETHHub on our internal kind of roadmap. So just a few different things. We've spoken about bounties a lot. We've got a lot more bounties for a lot more content going out very soon, just finding time to finalize that. We've got the community call and forum that we're still working on. We want to formalize that within the next couple of weeks, put it out there, get feedback and get people to start using the forum, get those conversations going, especially because these governance discussions are heating up or have been heating up for quite a while, and want to get ahead of it before it gets too crazy. Actually, speaking of governance, I forgot to mention before, I'll be on a panel Friday afternoon at EdCon talking about governance with a few people in the Ethereum community, and Vitalik's going to be emceeing that, so I'm really excited to be on that. If you're around, definitely come check it out. I'm going to try and hit on a lot of the core points in the, from the community side and from the kind of investor stakeholder side as well, as we have commonly thought that they're underrepresented in the community. And I want to discuss what we can do to improve Ethereum governance. And obviously we have the community call coming, so I'm going to be hitting on that a lot. But yeah, come check out the panel and hopefully you get something out of it. And then lastly, I wanted to say that we've got the landing page coming as well. We're in a redesign. So at the moment, the ethub.io landing page is just a bunch of links to our various kind of subsections. So we want to completely redesign that and have a proper landing page for people to look at, just so it's nicer to look at, basically. So all this stuff will be happening in the next month or two. Bounty's obviously ongoing, but the formalization of the community call and forum is our number one priority at the moment, because we definitely think it's the most important thing that we need to get out there, basically. So on that note, I'll move on to the news. One big piece of news this week that came out was the SEC issuing a crypto no action letter to a project. Now, I'm not an expert on what these sort of things are. Crypto lawyer Twitter blew up about this. There was a lot of different threads on this and what the implications are, and kind of things like that. So basically, this no action letter stipulated that the token that this company was selling is not a security based on a bunch of conditions. Now, these conditions are extremely restrictive. It's really weird. So some of them include that the token generated funds cannot be used to develop the company's platform technology. Like what? The tokens must be immediately useful. That's fine. I agree with that. You know, especially if they're trading, they should be useful, because we saw, you know, something like EOS that had a year-long ICO, and but the tokens were tradable from the get-go, which was quite insane because the platform wasn't live. You know, and then there's other ones like, I guess, something like Polkadot, which did their ICO in 2017. They're not live yet and you can't actually trade the tokens. But yeah, under this condition, the tokens must be immediately useful. So the platform must be live, of course, or some kind of MVP. The tokens must remain at a fixed price of $1. Like what? What? Like, it's just crazy. Like, it's not a lot of these projects aren't stable coins, right? And even stable coins don't remain at $1. It's just really weird. And there was a bunch of other conditions in there as well that just got weirder. So yeah, I'm curious to get your take on this, Eric. What did you think of this stuff?
Yeah, I guess there's two sides of this to me. First, as far as like the actual no action letter and what was going on here, like why did they even need a token for this? It was like, I think it was like a private jet charter company, and it was like reward points that can be redeemed for $1. So like, again, why even do you need blockchain for that? You don't. So that was kind of like a not that encouraging, I guess, because it wasn't like, oh, they gave, you know, a large ICO a free pass or something like that. What is encouraging, I guess, is just seeing the SEC put out some more regulation around this. So yes, it was a no action letter. It was their first no action letter around ICOs. But at the same time, they put out a pretty detailed framework around kind of what they thought like a good ICO would look like, or at least like some guidance to that, right? I'm far from a lawyer. I can't really comment on like what was in there and what people think of that. There's a lot of people on Twitter putting out good commentary around what it meant. But, you know, to me, it's just good to see more guidance coming out. Like, I don't want the crypto space to be overly regulated, but the reality is there's going to be some regulation. So the earlier we can get guidance around this stuff, the better. And just the fact that, I guess, the SEC is thinking about this. And, you know, I read the, I think it was like 13-page framework. There's definitely, you can tell that the SEC sees future value in crypto, right? They're not trying to throw a complete wet blanket over it. And I know people were kind of freaking out. Oh yeah, this no action letter, you know, it's useless because, you know, this ICO was meaningless to begin with. But, you know, it just means that they're thinking about it. And I don't think the regulators are out to kill crypto. Like, they might be misunderstanding it in some aspects, but I think as these frameworks get built out more and more, at least it's going to give people, you know, a sense of security, pun definitely intended, and what they can do as far as the SEC goes in the US.
Yeah, I think in the context of this project, the no action letter makes total sense. I think my kind of issue around it is if this these same conditions are applied to other kind of ICO projects or projects trying to raise money through ICOs and things like that, I just don't think it would fit. Now, obviously, this is a case-by-case basis, and you were, you know, talking about how there's a framework being built around this. The regulators move slow, but they do eventually move, and they do eventually give guidance. But I just wonder, you know, if they keep moving as slow as they are, whether a lot of business gets lost to other countries. Because I've already seen something like Binance, they operate out of a bunch of different jurisdictions. Like, I think their home base is Malta at the moment, which is quite friendly to crypto. Maybe projects start registering themselves out of there. We've already seen them register themselves out of kind of Switzerland and Zug and all these kind of havens, I guess, where the regulations aren't anywhere near as tight. So yeah, I'm just curious to see if innovation gets lost to other countries. You know, if America kind of drags their feet here. I don't think there's much clarity from other kind of Western societies like the UK or, I mean, Australia isn't Western, but like we're kind of the same where we don't have that much clarity around it either. So I hope that we see more clarity around this sort of stuff and not just a case-by-case kind of basis. I hope we see, like, as you said, a proper framework that gets formalized, that everyone kind of agrees on, and that it's fair. Or else, yeah, we're just going to see projects migrate to other countries, basically.
Yeah, fully agree with that. I mean, I think what we're going to see is more guidance and frameworks built out over the next coming years, and then that's going to give people more assurance for what they can get away with as far as ICOs go in the U.S. I still pretty strongly feel we're not going to see much retroactive action. So going back to previous ICOs, unless they were kind of like outright scams, right? Like, my hunch on the SEC has been that they're kind of just, hey, look, we didn't have the guidance at the time, not that many people got harmed per se. Like, do we even have the resources and the time to chase them all down, right? We've seen them go after a few outright scams, but I kind of think that's going to stay like that as far as the past goes, and they're just going to set up some regulation for the future. But I do think it's a concern for the US to be losing out on this value to other countries. You know, it'll be funny to see if crypto goes through another like huge boom and lots of value is being created, if the US realizes they're losing a lot of economic activity to other countries if they loosen up on it a bit.
Yeah, very curious to see how it plays out. We'll keep an eye on it, obviously, and I expect there to be a lot more developments over the next few years, especially during a bull market as well, if we have one of those again. Cool. So I'll move on to the project updates now. So another ETH2 client went live this week, Sigma Prime's Lighthouse client. So this is the second client that's actually live after Status's Nimbus client that went live last week. And now we're just waiting on Prismatic Labs. So these were the three core teams that were bringing out clients over the past couple of weeks. I think Prior Labs will probably do theirs this week or next week. The clients have their various trade-offs, and they're not, you know, they're just testing their clients at the end of the day. They're kind of alpha clients. They're not feature complete or anything like that, but they do have a few differences between them. You can go check out the GitHub to see what features come with each of these testnet clients. But yeah, it's just great to see another client live, especially from the Sigma Prime team, which is really cool. They have a couple of developers based in Australia, which is really awesome. Yeah, so if you haven't yet, go check it out on GitHub, go download it, start running it, you know, get some feedback back to the devs, because we're definitely in a kind of home stretch now to get the Beacon Chain live, hopefully by the end of the year or maybe even by early next year. But yeah, testnets being live bodes very well for the future of ETH2 and the future of the Beacon Chain, and just getting it out there, basically.
Yeah, I mean, the ETH2 teams continue to have their heads down and just not getting distracted by everything that the community seems to be getting distracted by right now, which is really cool to see. I mean, I ran the Status Nimbus testnet. I have not run the Sigma Prime one yet, but, you know, I guess if you could enter a meme into a podcast, I would put the "It's Happening Ron Paul" meme in right now, him waving his hands, because it's really cool to see ETH2 coming to life, right? Like, testnets are a huge step. We're starting to see talks of test cases online and like how all the teams are building those out and making sure they have a lot of good test coverage. And one cool thing is I have this Avato, which runs Dappnode, and I added them on Twitter yesterday, and I said, are you guys thinking about creating one-click installers for all the Ethereum 2 testnets? And they didn't say yes or no, but they sent back like a funny GIF that hinted that they were working on that. So I had to manually set up the Nimbus one myself, but it'd be really, really cool if Dappnode integrated the ETH2.0 testnets into their one-click installer packages, because I think then we would get a lot more people running in them, which would obviously help the testing.
Yeah, for sure. We're all about making it easier to use Ethereum at ETH Hub, and I think the clients are definitely on top of that too. The client team, sorry, are definitely on top of that too. And those one-click kind of staking, mechanisms is going to be very powerful. So hopefully, Avado integrates it or some other kind of, box, kind of node box or whatever you want to call it. So interesting to see how that plays out. So the next bit of news I wanted to discuss was Trust Token. They launched their True GBP stablecoin this week. So Trust Token is just another fiat-backed stablecoin. They kind of were born out of all the Tether controversy, just as a lot of the other fiat-backed stablecoins like USDC and GUSD were. But this is one of the first fiat-backed coins that aren't pegged to the US dollar. So this is obviously pegged to the British pound. So it's really cool to see that. Trust Token's a fully audited stablecoin. It's not like Tether where it's just dubious if they're actually fully backed or not. So I know that there's a lot of other projects working on getting more than just USD out there, especially Maker. When they launch Multicollateral DAI, they want to be hitting on basically every currency. So I'm looking forward to seeing more currencies come on board because for me, I don't use US dollars. I use Australian dollars, of course. I'm not aware of any actual Australian dollar stable coins. There probably are some out there, but yeah, at the moment I just track everything in US dollars. I think the entire cryptosphere tracks everything in US dollars mainly because that kind of leads the market. So I'm curious to see if these stable coins that are quoted in different currencies change that kind of dynamic there, maybe over time. But yeah, as it currently stands, it's basically USD dominated across the board, whether it's a stablecoin or just vanilla fiat as you you could call it these days. But yeah, interesting to see the British pound getting some love.
Yeah, I guess the stablecoin wars continue, right? I mean, it's another stablecoin, but at least it's a different currency pair, like you said. We'll definitely start seeing a lot of these. And like you mentioned, long-term Maker has plans to do EuroDai and kind of eventually I even think like a basket of currencies as well, so that you kind of take the risk out of each certain currency that's in that basket. What I'd like to see here too is like Set Protocol. We talk a lot about, they have a way to do like, you can buy into like a stable coin fund, which basically tracks, like, I think right now it tracks like three of the stable coins. It creates an ERC-20 for that. It'd be cool if they started integrating all these different, fiat stable coins over time into one basket. And then you could kind of take out the certain, FX currency risk for just holding, say, USD or pounds or euros or Australian dollars or whatever it might be. So I think that's where the power here eventually, like if you think about what Ethereum, like the vision of people that are using Ethereum, like no one probably really wants to be tied to one specific currency. But if you could leverage something like Set, which eventually could like combine all of these into one ERC-20, that would be a pretty cool thing to do.
I guess speaking of DeFi Open Finance, I'll move on to the next kind of little update here. So there's this website, I'm not sure how many people have seen it before, loanscan.io. Basically gives you a bunch of different metrics and stats around Compound, Dharma, and MakerDAO. You can see graphs of like how the volume on these platforms have grown over time. It's a really cool little site. I use it a lot to search for different metrics for a lot of DeFi apps that I pay attention to. This week they actually launched a little nice little feature. It's actually a small part of the site, but it's pretty powerful because I hadn't seen this before. But it basically compares the different lending and borrowing rates of all open finance and centralized finance platforms at a glance. So if you look at it, you can actually see in the open finance section, you can see Compound and Dharma Lever. You can see ETH, what the lending rate is for Compound, what it is for Dharma Lever. Same with DAI, same with a bunch of other stable coins and a couple of ERC-20 tokens. So it gives you a quick glance of, hey, look, you can lend a DAI out on Dharma Lever for 7%, or you can lend ETH out for 4%. And then you can see your borrowing as well. So you can borrow DAI on Compound for 11.2%. And then you can actually see the top borrowed assets too. So at the moment, like I'm just looking at it now, you can see that DAI is the top borrowed asset by far. There's 96% of the borrowed assets from the platforms that this site tracks is DAI. So it says, you know, the issued loans, 25 million DAI, 165,000 ETH, equals a total of 30 million. So, you know, it's really cool to see this at a glance and see all the different rates. The rates are quite varied, right? So, you know, Dharma Lever borrowing DAI is 4%, but on Compound it's 11.2% because they use different mechanisms, where Dharma is the kind of peer-to-peer, Compound's that money market protocol where it balances a bunch of different different assets in it. So yeah, it's just great to get this because I know it's going to be very helpful for me, especially even the centralized ones like something like Celsius or Poloniex as well. So yeah, it's really cool to see this.
Yeah, LoanScan is becoming kind of like a must bookmark utility for DeFi, right? Or for open finance. They kind of started as originally just tracking Dharma loans, and they've really expanded into kind of like a dashboard. This is really cool. Like, I always just manually go to each of these sites and kind of check out what the different rates are. So this is a great idea. I can't believe no one's done this yet, but it seems like the tooling around open finance is really blowing up. Like, we've talked about DeFi Pulse, and now we have LoanScan and, you know, Maker Tools, and I'm forgetting, you know, 10 or 15 of them, but like, this is important as far as analyzing a finance platform, right? And I think the arbitragers are starting to lick their chops a little bit. It's really funny to see, like you mentioned, there's a lot of variance in rates across the platforms, which over time, like, I almost want to take screenshots of this like once a month and watch these rates start to converge, because there's a lot of opportunities out there for gains and like mismatches across platforms and, you know, borrow here and lend here and make a spread on it. Like, those still exist. It's mainly because the user base is a little small right now and the friction's still there, of course. But like, over time, as that friction dries up and open finance expands more and more, we're going to see those spreads start to shrink down to next to nothing. So that'll be a really interesting thing to watch. And I guess I'll give a shout out. I just mentioned, you know, LoanScan initially was for Dharma loans. And I just saw this week that Dharma launched their platform for lending and borrowing to the public. So, or they just tweeted that out recently. So definitely go check that out too.
Yeah, Dharma tweeted that out like 12 hours after I put the newsletter out, so I didn't include it in this week's update. But yeah, their Dharma Lever platform's open to the public now. You can currently get, I think, yeah, 7% for lending DAI, which is insane. You know, I'm not sure what the loan terms are. I haven't checked yet, but yeah, I wouldn't say easy risk-free money, but it's there. So if you're if you're up for it, you can go lend some DAI and earn some money in the bear market. Or I don't know if we're calling it a bear market anymore, right? It's been an interesting couple of weeks with the price of Bitcoin spiking to over 5,000, ETH going back up to about 180. It's people are calling it a crypto spring, but it's only been, I think it's like 9 or 10 days since we started seeing these massive price moves again. So maybe it's too early. Maybe it's what the traders call a bull trap. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. In the meantime, yeah, just go earn some money on lending out your crypto assets if you're just sitting on them, basically.
Yeah, definitely. It'll be interesting. We talked about, you know, the E2.0 economics post I put out in the beginning. And like, one thing I've always wondered about is how DeFi is going to compete with staking return. And there's a lot of different aspects there. Like, there's not a lot of demand for lending ETH, because really, if you're borrowing ETH, you're probably just doing that to short it, right? You're going to borrow, you're going to short sell it, try and rebuy it back lower, and then you're going to make that spread. That's how shorting works. So I still think staking, you know, even at like a 2 or 3% annual return, is probably going to beat out DeFi options. But I think where we're seeing a lot of action on DeFi is on the DAI side, of course. So, you know, it's just so fascinating to watch all of these different assets get, lent out and borrowed, and like where the demand is. And, you know, as the market starts to turn over time too, like, it'll be really interesting to watch, you know, CDPs and the demand for DAI, and like, are people, you know, opening more CDPs to long ETH? Like, you know, at a new top, what's going to happen to the CDP system? Are people going to like panic and all the CDPs are going to get called because everyone was leveraging long Ether? Like, I think the next 2 years, and kind of watching how stable all of this is, the entire open finance system and how it matures, is going to be really probably the most fascinating thing to keep an eye on.
Yeah, for sure. And that's actually a perfect segue into the on-chain activity of this week. So I put out a tweet a couple of days ago. I think it was yesterday actually, and I don't think I included it in the newsletter. But basically, I compared the various DeFi protocols and kind of the value locked in them in a tree map. And you can see that the dominance of Maker is insane. It's up at around 88 or 89% of the total value locked. But that was actually over 90% a few weeks ago, and it's been waning. It's been, we've had the launch of Dharma Lever now to the public. We had it launch in privately a few weeks ago as well in private beta. We've had other protocols growing like Compound and things like that as well. So slowly chipping away at Maker's dominance, which is really good to see. I said in the tweet that I'm going to revisit the Tree Map in exactly a year. So April 9th, a year from now, basically, to see how it changes. And I actually fully expect Maker's dominance to keep being chipped away by these other more novel platforms or different platforms like, you know, Uniswap, Compound, Dharma, all these sorts of things. Because it just seems like every month there's a new DeFi protocol that comes out and starts locking a lot of value in it. But as you said before, we're going to converge. A lot of these rates are going to converge. A lot of these different things are going to get more efficient, because at the moment it's just an incredibly inefficient market or kind of lending and borrowing market. So I fully expect that to damper over time. But yeah, it's just interesting to see Maker losing its dominance. But it's not a bad thing. It's not like, Bitcoiners think that Bitcoin losing its dominance is a bad thing, because obviously it means that Bitcoin's worth less than the others, or the others are worth, more. But yeah, so Maker losing, it just means there's a more healthy market developing around DeFi in general.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we know that the use cases have to move beyond borrowing and lending, right? Especially until, we sound like a broken record on this, but until like identity and reputation systems come online, in my opinion, we've kind of hit a brick wall on like how far lending and borrowing can go. We have very over collateralized loans out there because we don't have those systems in place. And it's hard to do like trusted P2P loans unless they kind of, either an underwriter is vouching for them, like that's kind of the ultimate vision of Dharma, or you can trust them through some kind of identity or reputation. So that just means that now, Maker has, at a point, there's only going to be so many people that want to lock their Ether into the Maker system, right? I think that we're at like 2.3 million ETH or something like that right now. That might rise, of course, as price goes up and people want to leverage long a little bit more. But I expect this number to keep trending down. I think I'm very bullish on decentralized exchanges probably starting in 2020 or so. I think that scaling solutions coming online like StarkDex, that's going to introduce privacy and scaling at the same time to decentralized exchanges. I expect in the next bull run for there to probably be another catastrophic exchange hack, which is going to, kind of be a catalyst to, at the same time of scaling and privacy coming online, kind of a catalyst to decentralized exchanges. And then I guess we'll also have to consider things like Connects. I just talked to Seller Network. These are solutions that are going to be, instant, essentially feeless payment networks. I think we're going to see a lot of people start to lock up ETH in these as well, kind of as more, wallets and merchants start to integrate these solutions into their products. And so, that's going to be another aspect that starts to kind of drain away from this Maker dominance.
Yeah, exactly. I think we tend to forget, since we're in the weeds a lot, that we're still very early in this space, in the DeFi space. A lot of experimentation going on. That's why we're seeing all these inefficiencies. A lot of people trying to work out what's going on with these protocols, how they actually work. Like, I know when Uniswap first launched, there was a lot of confusion around it until Cyrus Unisi put out his awesome blog post explaining what Uniswap actually did. That's what made me understand it really at the end of the day, especially if you haven't got a finance background. This stuff's just insane. There's so many moving parts to it. And, given that it's the decentralized nature of it, you can use these apps yourself. You don't have to go through, traditionally a middleman to use it, which would do all the hard work for you. You can actually do it yourself, learn about it yourself, use the app and manage it all yourself. Like a Maker CDP is completely self-managed. And speaking of that, I actually fully expect maybe middlemen to pop up around this as well, like someone to manage your CDP, for example, which is funny when you think about it. We're just reintroducing middlemen, but at the end of the day, you still have that choice of whether to go through a middleman or, do it yourself, basically. I know what I'd prefer, but obviously there are a lot of people out there who don't want to worry about this sort of stuff, especially when it comes to, a CDP where you could lose money due to liquidations and things like that. It just becomes very, very scary, I think, for a lot of people. But we have the choice, and there's a lot of other benefits to it as well, of course. But as you said, we sound like broken records with DeFi stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing to talk about, right, for Ethereum right now. I'm very ready for it to move into the next use cases. I know I just talked about DEXs, and I'm really bullish on instant and essentially, I guess I'm just going to start calling them feeless because the fees are going to be so small, people aren't going to even care. Instant and feeless P2P DAI payments. I think once we can integrate and Ether payments too, but once we can integrate fiat to crypto on ramps into these layer two solutions, which I think is very close. That is going to be a huge push to get the mainstream on. If you can kind of show the power, like essentially it's a faster and cheaper Venmo, right? Like that's where we're going to get to eventually. As far as the user experience of that, how far away are we? I don't know, maybe still 2 years in all reality, but I think that's going to be a huge push on the DeFi front as well. Because even once you get there too, like just sending money across all these apps on layer two is going to be a lot better than on layer one.
Yeah, I think it also comes back to, as I was saying, we're very early and we're still, you know, there's growing pains as well. So even if the UI UX was kind of, I guess you could say solved or at a point where mainstream users could use this, we still have these other issues such as, like we've spoken about this the last few weeks, the stability of DAI at the moment is, you know, this is just due to growing pains, of course, I think, because we don't have multi-collateral DAI or the DAI savings rate in yet, but the DAI peg is still that, you know, it's still not at parity with a dollar yet. It's still at 97, 96 cents. People are still drawing DAI out of their CDP when they should be paying it back. That's the whole point of the stability fee being raised. And now we're seeing the stability fee, you know, it's at 7.5% now. We said that it's going to be raised again, probably, I think, to over 10% this time. You know, the DAI ceiling is still 100 million. We're at about 94 million at the moment. So we're getting very close. But DAI is still trading under its peg due to the fact that there's too much supply of DAI because everyone's buying ETH, especially because the price started moving. I've shared an interesting chart on Twitter from Matteo at The Block about how, depending on your kind of time preference, a stability fee of even 100% would not dissuade people from taking DAI if ETH goes up more than 100% during the year, because they're going to make they're still going to be in profit even though they've had to pay, like, you know, 100% on their of fees on their drawn DAI. They've still made it back with their ETH. So at the end of the day, they're actually still better off. So this is why I think the stability fee is definitely a short-term kind of fix, I guess you could call it. And it's definitely a growing pain for the system, because at the moment there's nowhere for that excess DAI to go. It just gets traded back, you know, back and forth, which kind of pushes the price of DAI down. But obviously in the future, we're going to have the DAI savings rate, which is a very important aspect of the system where people can lock in DAI. So non-CDP holders, people who just buy DAI on market. I mean, CDP holders can do it too, but it doesn't make much sense for them. It actually makes a lot of sense for people to buy DAI on market, put it into a low risk, low return kind of savings account, which is the DAI savings rate, lock it in there to get some of that DAI supply out of circulation and to make keep the peg. And my main point of this, I went on a bit of a tangent there, but my main point of that is that if we have these P2P payments and DAI is not at a dollar and it's at 96 cents, people are going to be like, why is it not at 96 cents? Why don't I have a dollar? Like, I just lost money. This is supposed to be stable. So we're still suffering from the same volatility that we get from ETH and Bitcoin and whatever other crypto asset that's not a stable coin. So I really think that we need to be careful about advertising these sorts of apps to a mainstream audience. I know that, you know, some people advertise something like the Lightning Network to a mainstream audience. The Lightning Network's not ready for that. A lot of the stuff on Ethereum's not ready for that. People are going to lose money. People are going to wonder what the hell's going on. A lot of people in the community hardly understand DeFi as it is, and we're going to start, you know, giving it to my mom to play around with DAI. So I think that these, you know, as I said, growing pains, we're going to solve this sort of stuff, but it's not just the UI UX at the end of the day, it's the underlying systems themselves and getting them production ready, I guess you could call it. All right, cool. Enough about Maker and DAI and DeFi. Just the last thing I wanted to talk about was an interesting tweet that was put out by recent hire Ivan Martinez. He'd recently joined Prismatic Labs as a core developer there, which is really cool. But he put out a nice little tweet thread, I've linked it in the newsletter, discussing the importance of the decision that's going to be made by the DevZen community to arrive at a kind of, I guess, nice long-term inflation rate for ETH 2.0. So we spoke about this at the start of the podcast a bit, and we spoke about this a lot, about the economics of Ethereum 2.0, especially in getting it right and getting that validator interest reward right. I think that Ivan basically put out a summary that said what we're going to need for the chain, what minimums we're going to need for the chain. how much ETH's going to be staked, what he expects to be staked, and the decisions around, you know, if there's this much ETH staked, but then there's more attractive opportunities in different, you know, DeFi protocols, will they go for that instead of staking their ETH? These are all very important considerations to make. But it's good to see core devs talking about this, because traditionally I haven't actually seen many core devs talk about the monetary aspect of Ethereum or the economics. It's been up to the community members, like especially, obviously, we talk about it a lot, but there's a few other community members that talk about it too. A few people put out spreadsheets. I think Colin Myers is his name from Consensus. He put out a ETH2 staking sheet. I know that, Eric, you've done it as well. I think he just expanded on yours and went deep with it. It was a pretty complicated sheet. But it's good to see, yeah, core devs talking about this, thinking about it. I want more of them to think about it, because at the end of the day, we need to get this right in ETH2, because it's one of the, if not the most important thing, I think, about the, you know, being able to incentivize people to stake is everything. Like, you know, you can build this awesome, really complex technical system that does everything you want it to do, but if the economics aren't right, I think obviously the incentives break down and we don't get exactly what we want out of the protocol.
Yeah, no, this was a really good thread, and like you said, just good in general to see the developers on the E2.0 site thinking about this. I mean, if you mess this up, no one's going to stake, right? So like all the work that's being done on E2.0, if you screw the economics up, it's not going to matter, because you're not going to get any stakers, or you're going to completely destroy the economics of the protocol, the underlying value, if you paid way too much for staking, and then that's going to be the flip side of that problem. So obviously this ties in very well to kind of that E2.0 economics page that we put out on the Medium that we were just talking about. You know, I fully agree with this. I've seen a lot of the researchers say, like, around the time of testnets, that's when they would like to kind of open the discussion on the economics side. So it's cool that testnets are starting to go live, and I think we're going to transition a little bit into the talk of the economics. I will say, I don't think they're really too far off. Like, I've kind of gone through a range of emotions on the economics of staking. When I first was diving into them, you know, I put out a thread months ago at this point, probably 6 months ago or something like that, around how I thought they were way too low in the initial spec, because I thought that DeFi was going to compete with them. Since then, DeFi's matured a good amount, and we've kind of seen what the lending rates on Ether are, and they're nowhere near what people thought they would be. They've always kind of settled in around 0.25% to like 0.5%, and that's an annual APR. And that's because, like I mentioned earlier, really the only reason to borrow ETH is at this point to short it. And it's very volatile, so you just don't really get people wanting to borrow ETH. So right now, like, it seems to me like, I mean, obviously we would want a lot of ETH staked, but, you know, let's just say around 10 million Ether staked is a pretty good target. That gives us solid cross-link communication. It gives us good security. Again, we would want more, but I think 10 million is going to be fine. I get the hunch, I don't want to speak for the researchers, but I get the hunch that's kind of the number they're targeting or thinking is going to be staked. And at this current moment, if we're looking at 10 million total staked, we're looking at about 2.54% interest rate paid to stakers. At current Ether price, that's barely in the profit for someone that's running one validator. So I think they're a little too low. I would say that they're probably 25 to 40% too low. I think they need to come up, but I don't think they need to come up a lot, because even at 2.5%, you're not going to probably beat that on DeFi. And even if you're beating that on DeFi, you're taking different risks than staking, right? Like, you're trusting the platform, you're trusting the code of all these different DeFi apps. If you're doing it through, say, a CDP or on Maker, you have liquidation risk. Like, these risks don't exist on staking. And there was a lockup risk for a while, but the time to exit has gone down a lot over the recent spec changes on the staking side. So, you know, I think 2.5% around 10 million, you're actually still going to get a decent amount of people there interested in it. But I would like to see it come up a little bit. So one thing I kind of sent back on this thread is, like, how can we organize these discussions? That's always a pretty important stipulation. And like, how do we make sure we get the right people involved for this discussion? So hopefully we can use, this could be one of the original use cases of this new ETHub community forum.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, staking is obviously going to be lower risk, but that what comes with that is lower reward, of course. If you want those massive gains or that massive reward, I think Maker CDPs are probably your best bet at this point. As I was explaining before, due to the nature of ETH's volatility, even a, like 100% stability fee wouldn't, you know, could still be profitable over a year, because the stability fee is kind of an annual fee. So 100% over a year, I mean, it's not uncommon for crypto to do 10 times, like even ETH and BTC to do 10 times over a year, depending on what kind of market we're in. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see what we, what, you know, how much ETH is staked in ETH 2.0. I think 10 million is probably, as you said, like the maximum. Because once it gets past that, the returns don't seem very attractive at all. But at the end of the day, people can withdraw their ETH and stop staking anytime they want. And then the rate will adjust for that. So I think it's just going to be a balancing act between all the DeFi protocols as well. But we have to get it right from the start, because we can't have kind of, we don't have that centralized control that various DeFi protocols do, you know, that they can subsidize things. So I know that Dharma is subsidizing some of their loans as well on there. And obviously in their full system, they'll have different people subsidizing loans and underwriting stuff and all that kind of jazz. Whereas with Ethereum, we want it to be fully self-managed, kind of like a fully autonomous organization, basically, or a DAO, you know, as it goes. So yeah, I'm really curious to see. We won't get any, I guess, really great data until maybe next year on this. At this point, testnets are, you know, a very bad indication of the economics, I think. They're not going to actually show what it's like in a real life environment. From a technical side, they're great, but yeah, from an economical kind of side, they're not very useful. So we'll see next year. And, you know, it might actually take longer than next year to see this stuff play out, because at the start, I do think that at the start, we need the interest rate to be very, very high to encourage those first kind of militant stakers to stake their ETH, because I don't think we'll see anywhere near 10 million at the start, because as it currently stands, it's a one-way bridge. So your ETH basically gets locked, until phase two of ETH 2.0, which is like 2021, 2022, I think, at this stage. So I think we'll say less than a million ETH staked at the start, probably a lot less than that, depending on the returns, especially because, you know, there are a lot of people that are sitting on their ETH, but maybe they don't want to risk it as well. Maybe they, you know, they think, oh, the price of ETH is going to go up a lot more before, I can move my ETH again, so I want to cash out now. There's a whole bunch of stuff happening, but, you know, maybe that we have a bridge eventually on ETH 2.0 back to ETH 1.0, or maybe the ETH 2.0. There's going to be a different ticker for ETH 2.0 as well, so we might be able to trade it. So there's so many different moving parts, and this is why I think it's a very important thing that the community needs to focus on a lot more, because it hasn't been given nearly enough thought. And I think it's up to the community to do this, because the core devs and researchers have a lot of other work to do on the technical side, and they can't just be sitting there thinking about the economics all the time. But I think, you know, and I think it matters a lot more to the community as well at large, because that's one kind of area that they have a voice in. And it comes back to the community call, where we want to amplify that voice of the stakeholders in the community, like the investors that feel underrepresented as well. So yeah, curious to see how it plays out anyway.
Yeah, one thing I really want to hear from like the E2 development teams and the researchers here is like kind of what their ideal target stake is. Like at a point, like it becomes very beneficial to have more and more stakers. And then like that definitely starts to trail off at a point, right? Like 10 million total staked is like 312,000 validators, I think. So like that's a lot of validators and a lot of decentralization there. So like what's kind of their ideal target? Is it 10 million? Is it 8 million? Is it 50 million? Like, because then you can kind of adjust the economic incentives to target that number, right? So I think that's a good way to go about it. And on the phase zero, I agree. We're going to see a lot less staked at that point. The good news is I think we only need like 300,000 or maybe 500,000 ETH staked to bootstrap the network. And around then you're talking like 10% or more return on your ether. So yeah, you're going to be taking a lot of risk, but I mean, you're going to gain 10% ether on your stack a year, right? So like, that's going to be pretty attractive to people. So yeah, I'm excited for these discussions. I guess that's the best way to put it.
Yeah, it's a much longer discussion than what we have time for, because I think we just hit time. So awesome. Cool. Thanks everyone for tuning in again. If you haven't yet, go subscribe to the newsletter that we've discussed at ethhub.substack.com. For sure, go and subscribe to the podcast as well at podcast.ethhub.io. And I hope to see some of you at EdCon over the next couple of days. Come find me, get your free ETH Hub sticker, and we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to the Into the Ether podcast. You can subscribe to us at podcast.ethhub.io, as well as follow us on Twitter at econoar and at Zazzle0x.